Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It's now once again time for an event on the U of I campus that has achieved fame and the people's ovation forever. It's now worldwide in its recognition. And what we're talking about here is the Insect Fear Film Festival, now in its 21st year. And about this time of year, you take a little time to talk with the person who assumes direct responsibility for the festival, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at University of Illinois. She's a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is here on the program, mostly during the summer when insects are most active, to answer questions. And we always say when she's here, we say, save your extermination questions for another day. We've got a guy for that. Phil Nixon, our friend, who is an extension entomologist, and even though he's also a bug lover himself, saying we want to make sure people understand that, he is the guy that we turn to if you have an insect problem and you have to get rid of it. But when May is on the show, we do something different. It's an opportunity for people to call up and indulge their curiosity about insects because they are very interesting and very varied. And we do this thing where we sort of say, well, if you've seen an insect and you're curious about it, give us the best description that you can, and May will try and, based on that, tell you what it is. And if you have other sorts of questions about insects, we do that too. And in fact, we could do that here this morning. But particularly what we want to do here is to give her a chance to talk about this year's festival and preview a little bit the films that are going to be shown. And if you have not ever attended this thing, you might want to think about it. It's coming up here this weekend. It's an opportunity to enjoy some movies, sometimes of dubious social content, and at the same time, really learn about insects. And that's really why she started this thing in the first place, to counter some of the misinformation that was put out there about insects by the folks in Hollywood. So that's it. I think I've said it all. Drive careful. See you. Thanks very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
21 years now this thing has been going. Did you ever think at the beginning that this would have the legs, as they say in Hollywood?
Well, of course it has legs.
How
has
many?
More legs than you can count.
Okay.
But no. Well, last year I thought was a real landmark. You know, it was our 20th festival, and we actually invited a Hollywood director who attended our festival, Mr. Burt I. Gordon. As he's known in the business, Mr. Big, not only for his initials, B-I-G, but because much of his career was based on enormously oversized creatures of one form or another terrorizing humanity. So he was the director, producer, screenwriter, and special effects coordinator for Beginning of the End, which was giant grasshoppers attacking central Illinois, as well as Empire of the Ants and Earth Forces the Spider and many other classic insect fear films. No director this year on our 21st, but we do have a theme, as we generally do. And this year it's genetically engineered insect fear films, or bioengineered bugs. Mm-hmm. So if you've been worried about what the horrible unintended consequences of genetic engineering of insects and other organisms might be, here's your chance to indulge in wild and grossly off-the-mark speculation.
Well, that's what one of the things that points out why sometimes looking at science fiction films are interesting, because what it does is at any time it tells you what it is we're afraid of. The last thing apparently we're afraid of was radiation.
Well, there's...
And then now it's genetic engineering.
Well, you missed a phase in there. Oh. Insect fear films reflect the technology fears of the decades. Mm. So the 50s definitely was atomic radiation. So, in fact, the giant grasshoppers of Beginning of the End were produced by radiation experiments in the Rantoul USDA lab, with an effort to grow giant oversized tomatoes to feed the masses.
Those wacky kids at the Rantoul USDA lab, you got to keep an eye on them.
In fact, there's one great line with Peter Graves plays the scientist. His assistant has been struck mute by his work with radiation, and Peter Graves at one point says somberly, working with radiation can be dangerous. In fact, this is the same guy who later in the film tries to convince the U.S. Army that they quote, you can't drop an atom bomb on Chicago, which was, of course, their answer to giant locusts marching down Michigan Avenue, the Magnificent Mile. So that the 50s was radiation into the 60s, and the 70s was fear of toxic pollution. So, you know, this was the Earth Day decade, so chemical waste, toxic pollutants. And then in the 80s, which was not one of the great decades for much of any kind of pop culture, it was radioactive toxic waste.
kind of put those two things together.
Themes, yeah. And in 1982, Rubin and Spradling published a paper demonstrating the practicality of genetic engineering of insects, so sort of raising the possibility. And by the 90s, it was possible, and in fact, lots of mutant genetically engineered insects running around in laboratories all over. So this is the era of DNA and genetic manipulation. So we now have enough for a festival.
All right. Well, I tell you, we have some callers. We will talk about the festival. We can talk a little bit about the movies that you're showing. But rather than make these folks wait forever, why don't we talk with them? We'll start with the caller in Urbana and line number one. Hello.
This has got to be a bit of old business, and it only applies if you have seen episodes of the TV show CSI Crime Scene Investigator.
I'm a huge fan.
What was your first reaction when the Gil Grissom character, played by William Peterson, started to expound on the life cycles of certain insects?
I was thrilled. You know how many lead characters and lead admirable characters in television shows have an interest in insects? He raises and races cockroaches. That's one of his avocations. He has cockroach colonies at his house. Of course, he's also sort of presented as being socially a bit dysfunctional. But I love the way they, you know, in reality, and insects are an important part of forensic science. And it's a long-established practice to use insect fauna of carrion, of dead bodies, to estimate post-mortem interval.
Well, TV Guide magazine kind of blew the whistle on the content of those insect lectures, though. Did you get onto that just immediately, that some of the stuff he was saying was incorrect?
Or oh, yeah. Well, incorrect? In fact, I watched the show religiously in the hope of catching Gil Grissom in an error. And it, often what he says is correct. It's out of a textbook. It's not always pronounced properly.
Uh-huh.
But the insects that they use are almost never what they say they are.
Oh.
So they'll use mealworms and call them hister beetles or something. You know, they just, if you know what you're looking for, you know they're not the right species. But I applaud the effort and the and at least the exposure, because forensic entomology is a really hot topic right now. If you're not averse to sort of plucking maggots out of dead bodies.
So. Well, thank you so much.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. One, would you spell your last name slowly so I can get it down on a piece of paper?
Sure. Actually, that is, I think, the easiest question I've ever gotten on Focus 580. Thank you. This is one I know I'll get right. So it's B as in boy, E-R, E-N as in Nancy, B as in boy, A-U-M.
Yeah. Okay, then the second one, could you give those titles of those first two books, Nits and Gnats or something?
Oh, sure. Thank you again. The first one, they're both U of I Press, University of Illinois Press. The first is called 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers. So Gnat, of course, starts with a G, but it's a silent G.
Okay, yeah.
And the second one is 99 More, Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. And long on the back burner and only a fraction done is the, I think it's 99 Additional Aphids, Antlions, and Annoyances. Or I really need to get to work on that one.
Okay,
so.
Okay, well, those only two I really knew about. And third, the more important question in a sense, oftentimes when you go out in your backyard, you'll see, and for lack of what it's actually called, is a swarm of very tiny winged insects that keep their spatiality,
yep.
I'll say,
yep.
and just sort of have a high-o time. And I remember as a child, and that's when I first got interested in what you've turned into a career, and I got to the place where I couldn't get into the literature, you know, to read those kinds of things. And my next question is along, if you could explain about the swarm and what possibly they might be here in central, I'm in north central Indiana, so it should be very much the same as in central Indiana.
Sure.
What they are, and are there a bunch of different ones that do it? Is it always the same group? And is it temperature related, seasonal related, sun angle related, and that sort of thing?
Well, hate to say it on a family show, it's actually sex related.
Yeah, I knew that. I just, yeah.
These are
and somewhere in there. Could you throw in a journal that?
Oh, an article?
How know, about well, not a, necessarily just a journal that I could get to at, say, like at Purdue to look at, which would is more generally structured for entomology, but doesn't it's not going to get into say statistical math or. The fine things they might be doing in DNA. I'm more interested in sort of a thing to be aimed at an early graduate student level, something like that.
Sure. Well, in terms of journals to read, if you're interested in insects, what I'd recommend is it's called American Entomologist, and
okay.
It's a publication of the Entomological Society of America.
Okay.
And it's general interest stories. It's not scientific reports.
Yeah.
So it's
totally
approachable.
Yeah.
And very engaging reading. The fact that I write a column for it is kind of incidental, but
okay.
they have.
But things are mentioned, the Latin name, that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's peer reviewed. It's scientifically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
There are abundant references in each article, but it's written. For the general entomological audience. So, it's not always easy for someone who does sweet potato weevil management to read a paper on DNA methods. So it's a sort of, general magazine for entomologists across the discipline. So it is very well written. Now, I forgot your – the gnats. Do you want to hear about the tiny
the
flies? Yes.
Is that what you call it? Or is it
they're gnats, chironomids most likely.
Is that the C-H?
Yes, exactly. C-H-I-R-O-N-O, M-I-D-A-E.
Yeah.
Okay. And the chironomids breed, grow up in their immature stages in sort of standing water sorts of situations, not always the nicest water.
Yeah.
And when they emerge as adults, this is a mating swarm or a mating aggregation, and they do seem to be suspended in the air. And how they pick their spots, entomologists aren't too clear, but it is abundantly clear that they're very loyal to those spots.
Yeah.
And there's often some topographic clue to them that this is a good place to aggregate, and they'll form these mass aggregations, most of which are male. And the females, which tend to come out a little bit after the males, will emerge and hunt for these suspended clouds of sex-hungry males.
I thought they were both together and somehow were, sizing each other up,
Well, eventually the females enter the swarm. So, but it is a kind of a massive display of I can't really say testosterone-driven interest in mating, and very hard to move them from their spot once they've settled on one.
Yeah, I used to try to jump my head into in the sunlight. They're really nice.
Well, let's hope no males mistook you for a female. That would have been pretty embarrassing.
Well, thanks a lot. I want to get a lot of other people. But,
thank you.
All right.
I assure you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks a lot.
I have also seen these things, and it seems to me that, I was in my way in back and forth between my house and work, I cross over the boneyard. And that's a place that several times of the year, I have encountered these things, these swarms of gnats. So that would make sense that they would be around there, around the creek. That
absolutely.
Would be the place that they would like to hang in.
They're not always in the freshest of, most pristine of streams and the like, and in fact, there's some other flies of that ilk that do this behavior. Chironomids are notorious for being able to survive under the most challenging conditions as larvae. They live in sort of mine waste pits with pH down in the range of 2, and in fact, there's a whole list of species that various environmental assessors use to judge just how low quality water is. If you identify a particular species, it means the water quality is really bad.
Mm. Okay. We have some other callers here, and maybe I should introduce again our guest. For anybody who doesn't know, we're talking with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is here on the show to talk about that. Again, we say, save your extermination questions for another day, but if you are curious about insects and how they live their lives, we'd be happy to take those questions. And at some point here, we'll talk a little bit more about the 21st Annual Insect Fear Film Festival going on this weekend on the U of I campus at the Follinger Auditorium. And it's free and open to anybody who would like to go. Back to the phones here. Belgium over by Danville. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. How are you all today?
Good.
Fine.
I'd like to ask you about a species that seems to begin to develop a problem here in the United States, and probably not important to many people other than woodworkers, which I happen to be one of. There is a pest that's come from Asia called the green Asian borer, I think, that affects ash trees.
Oh, the emerald ash borer.
Emerald, yes. Ash borer, uh-huh. Okay. I was wondering, it's very prevalent in the area where the last caller came from, Michigan, southeast Michigan, central Michigan. Seems to have been introduced by packing and crating and stuff from Asia. Has it made it to the Illinois area yet?
There is a tremendous apprehension about this pest, and you're absolutely right. Michigan's been very hard hit. It's a Buprestid beetle.
Pardon me?
The family it belongs to is Buprestidae. It's a different family from the Asian longhorn beetle, which has also gotten a lot of publicity. They're called the flat-headed borers is their common name. And it is a spectacular emerald green, like the name suggests, and it's a recent introduction. And it's reasonably host-specific on ash and its relatives, but it does a real number on ash. There's considerable trepidation that eventually it'll make its way to Illinois, which needs all the trees it can get.
Ash is a very nice wood to work with, and it doesn't seem to – it affects all the ash, the black,
right,
the green, brown, several different ash varieties.
Yeah, and it has a – just like many borers, they live in the – heartwood of the tree, so as they tunnel through it.
I thought it was in the Cambrian.
They cut through the living tissue, the phloem equivalent of the tissue, and of the equivalent of phloem tissue, which is, you're absolutely correct. So they cut the, basically cut the circulatory system off.
Yeah, cut the nutrients off to the rest of the tree.
Exactly. So the tree dies with, it doesn't require enormous numbers either.
No.
They're hard to detect because they're burrowing through the wood, so there's no obvious external manifestation of their presence. So very hard to catch them, very hard to control them. So there's an intensive effort in places where they've already become established to halt their spread. And about like with Asian longhorn beetles, about the only thing you can do is just
cut the tree.
Exactly.
And now, does it affect the does it affect the actual lumber, or does it just eat underneath the bark?
Well, it kills the trees, among other things, so that would eventually affect the lumber supply.
Well, you could still use the lumber if it doesn't burrow through the lumber. See what I'm saying? Some beetles will chew clear through the wood, you know, and destroy the lumber.
You know, I also know that there's a limited market for what's called character marked wood.
Yes, ma'am, but there's a lot more market for the
that's
one that's
true.
Good.
Well, you know, I have a colleague here whose specialty is boring beetles. He's himself not boring, but his work is. His name is Dr. Larry Hanks, and I know he's been involved with some of these emerald ash borer monitoring efforts. So he's in our department, and if you have he would be more knowledgeable than I about the extent of the damage to the trees and sort of the economic impact of this insect that whose presence here is not welcomed, as far as I know, by anyone. So.
Well, the reason why I ask this question is because I own some property here that I'm on, and we have lost several large ash trees.
They
seem to attack ash trees first, and they die, and the trees die at the upper levels first and then work down.
Yeah, are you in Illinois?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, ma'am. I'm just barely in Illinois, but I am in Illinois.
Well, I would suggest if you give Dr. Hanks a call, I think is, I hope he doesn't mind my giving his number. Well, you can reach him through our department.
Yes, just the Department of Entomology,
yes,
at the University of Illinois.
333-2910.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you. You know, it's funny. I always bring, as David can well attest, these questions come from all directions, and I just like to be accurate when I'm on the air, and it's sometimes hard to think on your feet. So I bring books that are sort of survey books of general insects likely to be to come to people's attention. But the ones that come to people's attention are the brand new pests, and they're not in these books because these are not new books. So what I need here is a laptop because USDA will have fact sheets on all the invasive species. So undoubtedly at USDA sites you can find a fact sheet on the emerald ash borer.
We have some other folks to talk with, and next we'll talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about the Insect Fear Film Festival.
Great.
Professor Barenbaum.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard so much buzz about this film, Cicada Bonanza.
Huh. Cicada Bonanza. This is a new one on me. How can this be? Can you tell me about it?
Well, I think it was shot here locally, perhaps by one of the students. I was
no
just wondering
kidding.
If it, I was just wondering if it was going to be premiered.
Well, that's interesting. Now that you mention it, I teach a course called Insects and People. It's a general education course. So
uh-huh.
For students who have a 3-hour life science requirement that they must fulfill one way or another and often do so without tremendous enthusiasm, they take my course because it fits their schedule, not because they've got a compelling long-term interest in insects. But the goal in the course is to relate insects to other aspects of human achievement, including pop culture. So every year I do have students that have made films
uh-huh.
as their term project. And Cicada, what was
Bonanza.
It? Bonanza. Doesn't strike a familiar chord. I know one film that was made last year for class that, by the way, got an A, I believe it premiered at Mike and Molly's last spring and appeared at a number of other venues in town. So I encourage everyone, though, to support uh-huh. Insects in the Arts. I think if I see an announcement, I'll try to get to that, definitely get to a screening of that film.
Well, we'll be there nonetheless.
That's
right.
Great.
Thanks for the call.
Super,
now,
thanks.
If people did have films that they would like to submit for perhaps for airing at future festivals, is that would you be up for that?
Not out of the realm of possibility. We have the unusual distinction of being listed as a film festival in an encyclopedia entry on film festivals, even though the traditional film festivals are ones where films are submitted and judged. Generally, in our case, I don't know if judging is...
Judgment has probably been passed already
judgment
on many of these films.
Judgment has nothing to do with our festival
yeah.
here.
Lack of judgment, maybe. All right, well...
But sure, I mean, insects in the arts, onward and upward.
All right, let's go on. Normal, Illinois. Next caller here, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about... the story Little House on the Prairie, I've been reading it to my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one story where they're in Minnesota.
And there's a locust plague.
Yeah.
Right.
The grasshoppers.
Yep.
She describes that
mm-hmm.
just walking over the house
yep.
and going west.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
absolutely accurate? Yep. In the 1870s, there was an outbreak of many years' duration in this part of the country of what was called the Rocky Mountain locust, Melanopolis spiritus. It rivaled any outbreak of locust at any time in historical records. There were literally trillions of locusts in this outbreak. Their collective biomass outweighed that of the buffalo, which at the time were extremely numerous. It's not clear what triggered this massive outbreak, but it's historical record that parts of Minnesota were utterly devastated, as well as Nebraska, Missouri. In fact, the governor declared a statewide day of prayer to get rid of these, you know, to drive the locusts away. In Minnesota, there was a town that built a church in order to collectively worship to get rid of this horrible plague, and it's still there. You can go visit the Grasshopper Church up in Minnesota. Quite remember the name of the town, but it you can. There's only one in the internet. If you do a Google search on Grasshopper Church, I think it'll come up. And the funny thing is, or at least the entomologically funny thing about Melanopolis spratus, this is was at one point in time the most numerous insect in the Western Hemisphere, and now it's extinct. As far as anyone can tell, it has disappeared. There was some controversy as to whether it was simply the migratory phase of another species, Melanopolis sanguinipes, which occasionally reaches outbreak proportions. That's the red-legged grasshopper. But there's now a general consensus that it was a separate species. There's DNA evidence of preserved specimens. There's also morphological evidence of some specimens that are, you know, pinned in museums. That this was itself a distinctive species. And there's speculation is rife as to how something that was once the most abundant, you know, complex organism or animal on the continent just totally disappear from existence. And there are lots of theories. There's a new book that's coming out probably next month by Jeffrey Lockwood, who's dedicated his whole life to the study of grasshoppers. Speculating that the disappearance of the bison and the disappearance of the locust Melanopus spratus were linked, that the bison actually manipulated prairie grasses in such a way as to make the environment suitable for locusts. And when they went, their environment kind of disappeared as well. So it's one of these abominable mysteries as to where the Rocky Mountain locust disappeared. But from historical accounts, Laura Ingalls Wilder was not far off. I mean, they would land on people's clothes and chew through the clothes just because of the salt and the sweat. They'd chew down wood, you know, hoe handles. It was a major question in Congress about whether people would starve in these states and how much money to allocate to make sure that these homesteaders just didn't die of starvation.
The part of the story, you know, they're walking west and then they just start flying. Were they going back west to their home or?
What migratory locusts do and what they still do in the Middle East is with periodic unfavorable weather conditions, their breeding area contracts. Most grasshoppers require some soil moisture. At the egg stage, their eggs are laid in the soil and in these little sort of pods or cases. And if the soil's too dry, then the eggs don't hatch properly. So when there's intermittent or localized drying, they get more and more concentrated onto smaller and smaller patches of suitable land until they reach a point where population densities are so high that they take off en masse and at least in the Middle East follow prevailing wind patterns. To go to places where they'll be deposited and the climatic conditions will be more favorable. That is more, there'll be more precipitation. Okay. So there's no return flight. It's not like the monarch. They don't go back to where they came from.
Just took off when it wasn't desirable anymore.
Right, and they also have a tendency to, when a swarm passes overhead, it's one of the signals for grasshoppers on the ground to fly up and join them. So they end up, you know, the mass gets bigger and bigger and bigger, so it can literally blacken the sky. It's just must have been terrifying.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're about midway through, or a little bit past the midway point, with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. Every once in a while, on the show here, we talk about insects. Appreciate them. Hold your extermination questions. Probably one of these days, not too long, we'll have Phil Nixon on the show, and he can deal with those sorts of things. But if you're curious about insects, you have questions about them, you can call. And we do want to hear, be a good opportunity, we don't have anybody holding on here, to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the festival coming up this weekend and the movies that you're going to show.
Okay, well, this year we have the distinction of showing two films that were specifically mentioned by Roger Ebert in his reviews of being particularly well-suited to the Insect Fear Film Festival. The first feature, as usual, we start with PG-13, something family-friendly, And this year it's The Tuxedo, a 2002 film with Jackie Chan, which features an unscrupulous magnate, industrial magnate who sells bottled water, who is planning to destroy the world's water supply so that everyone will have to buy his bottled water. And to do so, he is employing a genetically engineered, and I hope I'm not giving away too much of the plot here, water strider. Water striders are in the family Geraniidae. They're true bugs, and they ride on the surface tension. That's why they're called water striders. In England, they're called Jesus bugs because they walk on water. And they feed, they're predaceous. They feed on other insects that get trapped in the surface tension. In the film, they're enormous, and they have a complex social structure, like with a queen. I don't know why filmmakers insist on giving all insects a caste system and royalty. There's there was, a king spider in Arachnophobia. And then don't forget the famous mother-in-law spider of Spider 2001.
How could we?
Mother-in-law, yes. Anything more frightening than that? Our second feature is Mimic, which is an interesting film. This is one that Roger Ebert on his television show specifically mentioned as suitable for the Insect Fear Film Festival. And it was one that was well-received by critics, but not so well-received by entomologists because it has some of the same biological improbabilities. Basically, Dr. Susan Tyler, played by Mira Sorvino, is an entomologist who creates a genetically engineered creature she calls a Judas breed or Judas bug, which is part termite, part mantis, part cockroach, to spread a disease that will spread a microbe that will somehow quell another disease-causing organism that's wiping out the children of New York. And it's supposed to be genetically engineered to terminate itself, but of course, four years, I guess, later, it shows up in the subways of New York, 6 feet tall, assuming the appearance of humans and preying on people who missed the A train to 125th Street. So, again, there's an effort to be scientifically plausible. For example, the screenwriters had heard you can't that insects don't use lungs to breathe. And the fact that they rely on this, what's called a tracheal respiratory system, is what keeps them small because it's a system of pipes that delivers air to every cell in the body, and it just doesn't work when you get too big. So the screenwriter sort of dutifully notes that in the course of the 4 years of evolution, they've developed lungs so they can now be 6 feet tall. I don't know where those genes came from. And there's other sorts of howling errors that the supposed entomological mentor of Dr. Susan Tyler manages to utter. They sound scientific, but they make utterly no sense at all. Very entertaining if you're an entomologist. We have a low threshold, actually. We're all crack up. At one point, he talks about the phylum Insecta, which really breaks him up back at the department. What's so funny? It's class Insecta, not phylum Insecta, phylum Arthropoda. You know,
it's one of those jokes.
One of these scientist jokes. So, Susan Tyler, Mira Sorvino actually studied for this role by spending a day with Dr. Tom Eisner, who's an animal insect behaviorist at Cornell. And I know Dr. Eisner. He related the story that she called him up. Her dad, actually, Paul Sorvino, lives in Tenafly, New Jersey. She called up and said, "I'm making a film. Can I spend the day with you?" And he'd never heard of her. She had mentioned she had just won the Academy Award for Best Actress in Mighty Aphrodite. So there was an effort for verisimilitude. It just fell a little short. And then our last feature, as usual, the worst for last, is Tail Sting, which is, I think, I couldn't find an Ebert review because I think it went direct to video. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. And it's giant genetically engineered scorpions that break loose of the cargo hold in an airplane en route from Sydney, Australia to Los Angeles. That I think they were being genetically engineered for some sort of medical boon, and then they were being taken over for nefarious defense purposes. So those are the features. We have some very strange shorts this year as well. For the first time, we'll be showing an episode of Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which, if you haven't seen it on Cartoon Network, is about fast food superheroes. So it's a bag of French
big
fries.
Big bag of French fries, a big soft drink, and something that looks
kind
of like a sort of like a meatball.
Yeah.
And they kind of float. It's a very strange thing, yes.
And there's an episode about Monster Mothman that we'll be showing. And they also, Cartoon Network was great. They gave us video of both of these cartoons. Powerpuff Girls, Insect Inside. It's actually the very first episode. It's about... not clear that it's genetically engineered, but it's an engineered giant cockroach that threatens the town of, I think it's called Townsville?
Townsville.
Yes.
The city of Townsville.
And the Powerpuff Girls have to overcome their fear of insects. And then we have a G.I. Joe episode. I think it's called Infested Island. And then a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle episode, too, about Bugman. So... from 6 to 7, it's Folinger Auditorium, Saturday, February 28th. Doors open at 6, and we'll have our usual insect petting zoo. So we'll have live specimens. We'll have all kinds of pinned specimens. Anything thematically relevant. We'll try to have some genetically engineered fruit flies on hand for you to see. So you can see the reality. Not so scary. Most of these mutant fruit flies can't really even... fly out of their containers. Well, we'll try to get a range of mutants for people to see.
Okay.
And fun. It's free, absolutely free.
All right. That's this weekend, folks, on the U of I campus. So on Saturday, you got nothing else to do. Round up the kids and take them down to the Insect Fear Film Festival at Folinger on the campus. And it's free. And we have a couple of other callers here to talk with. Let's do that. And next is Downs, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I think this is an insect question. For several years, we have found on our kitchen counter in the morning, in two specific places, not every day, you know, just occasionally, sometimes it goes on for a couple of days and then it's gone, a little pile of something that looks like, burned toast crumbs. And occasionally it will have a very fine, what looks like an insect leg to me in it. And... for a while, if you got it wet, it turned bright pink, sort of like cochineal. And I have no idea what this is or where it comes from.
Well, that's...
graveyards or something?
Well, is it sawdusty?
No.
Interesting.
No, it's a bigger crumb than that. It looks like you've burned your toast and scraped it off.
One possibility is there are... none of the possibilities are that pleasant, actually.
Oh, wonderful.
The scarlet or pink color is really kind of puzzling.
Well, it's not always. That was for a short time.
There are some insects that are called dermestids that are skin and hide beetles. That's their common name. And they will burrow through... any kind of dead animal material, you know, skin, fur, feathers, anything like that. And they'll leave a little pile of cast skins that kind of looks toast-like. But why it would accumulate, I mean, it would take them some considerable length of time to make a little stack, a little pile like that.
Well, I mean, it's not terribly much, but it certainly is noticeable. I mean, you just go, oh, it's there again.
Wow. My first instinct was carpenter ants, and that's but if it's not sawdust, then it's not carpenter ants.
No, it's not sawdust.
Potentially could be some sort of stored product beetle. There are stored product beetles that burrow through plant material as well. They're in a different family, like in the anabiid family. The so-called drugstore beetle can make a meal out of just about anything in your kitchen, including cayenne pepper, spices, anything. And it burrows through, it creates, well, this material that entomologists call frass, which is what most people would call excrement. And depending on what they're burrowing through, the particle size would differ. So it might be an infestation of drugstore beetles or some other stored product.
It isn't close to anything. It's in these two places.
It's not coming from the ceiling,
Well... I keep looking at that, but there's nothing on the ceiling, and I just can't figure it out. Thought maybe
if you can bottle it up and and send it in, Okay. We'll try to get you a name on it. So
okay.
If you just a little, if you have a little, I don't know, empty spice jar or, dram vial, whatever, send it to the Department of Entomology and we'll put the whole force of the department on this mystery. So.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All Something right. to think about there.
Crime scene investigation.
Yeah.
Champaign, Urbana.
Move over Gil Grissom.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We'll go on here to Champaign for our next person here, line one. Hello.
Hello. You were talking about water striders a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this other water bug that looks sort of like a VW that scoots all over the top of the water.
Yes, that's a gyrinid. It's called a whirligig beetle.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful description of looking like a VW bug. It's all sort of convex and shiny.
Uh-huh. Well, usually every time I've seen them, they're going every which way.
Yep, they call them whirligig beetles because they do move in circles.
But one time I saw them and they were going in a large oval pattern.
Hmm.
And I wondered if you'd ever come across that.
I've never seen the large oval pattern, but it's well known that surface-dwelling arthropods do communicate by means of signals on the surface tension. The gerids, the water bugs we talked about before, send vibrations across the surface and, in fact, even relay these things down the length of the body of water to kind of like, Lord Admiral Nelson did... to his string of ships off the coast of Cadiz to, with semaphore signals. They just relay them, any alarm signals go from one flotilla to the next. And gyrinids, the whirligig beetles, can interpret vibrations on the water surface and also are very chemically sophisticated. They produce all kinds of chemical signals. So there might be... the oval might be the result of communication, either using surface tension or some of these pheromones, chemical signals.
Do you know anyone who studies them?
I know people who study the gerids, but the whirligig beetles, I can't think of anyone immediately who's looked at their communication.
I was interested in taking... videos for a while, and I captured that on a video.
Oh, you did? Boy, it makes me a little
bit... fell off the riverbank doing it.
Yeah, well, it makes me car sick to watch them, so... Because they just go, like you say, they go in circles. So.
Well, this wouldn't make you car sick, because it was a steady pattern.
Don't underestimate my capacity for nausea.
Oh.
Much as I would love to watch them. Now, one thing that people are intrigued by, I don't know if you took a good look at them, but because they live on the water surface, they have essentially four eyes. Their eyes are divided in half, and half scan the skies looking for predators, and the other half look down underneath for things to eat and for dangers from below.
Yeah, that's a neat trick.
Yeah, so they're really remarkable insects. It's not just that they can skate, they can also fly and dive. They're sort of like the decathlon beetles of the world.
Well, thank you. I'll give someone else a turn.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. We're doing one of those shows. We talk about insects and invite people's questions. And part of the reason to have her here right now is just to talk about this coming weekend's Insect Fear Film Festival on the U of I campus.
One more gyrinid story, which is apropos of nothing, but there's a book when I was just becoming an entomologist called How to Know the Beetles by Jaques, spiral-bound book, and managed to have, even though it wasn't that big a book, and there are, of course, something on the order of 350,000 species of beetles. There's a lot of beetles. I remember the gyrinid entry because... I mentioned they do produce these chemical substances, and some of them, in fact, are described as even smelling fairly pleasant. But what Jaques said about them is they're sometimes called penny bugs because if you put them under your pillow, there'll be a scent there the next morning. So. The more that entomological humor.
The more entomological humor, yeah.
It cracked me up. What can I tell you?
somebody suggested that I might ask you to talk a little bit about the Asian multicolored lady beetle, just because last year it seemed like we had a boom year for it. I was in December at Christmas time. I was visiting my dad and stepmom at their place in Glen Ellen, and we were sitting there in the kitchen, and I hear this sort of tapping up around the light. I'm looking up and say, "You have Asian multicolored lady beetle," and apparently it's still in December. They still had a few in their house.
Oh, they're still in the houses now.
Well, that's what somebody told me, that they know someone who even now they have them in their houses.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is sort of the reality of insect fear. This is a real invasion. These are real swarms, as it were. Multicolored Asian ladybug is Harmonia axeritus. It is, in fact, a true ladybug, just like the, red and black spotted guys that everybody has come to know and love, that Eric Carle wrote the grouchy ladybug about. And this is a species that was brought over multiple times from Asia up to 20 years ago and more recently. For biological control, the use of natural enemies to suppress or maintain, manage an insect pest species. And they were actually brought over to control aphids in trees, like pecan aphids, because not that many ladybugs will sort of go into trees to eat aphids. And for whatever reason, they didn't take. They didn't catch on. They didn't do their job. They just sort of disappeared from everybody's radar until within the last 10 years, for reasons that are not well known. There are also all kinds of speculation. There was a new shipment that came in through New Orleans of a more aggressive strain. Nobody knows why, but all of a sudden they're everywhere. And they are a huge problem because they're not ideal biological control agents in that they eat anything soft-bodied that is slower than they are, and that's a very long list. They'll eat caterpillars. They'll eat monarch caterpillars. They'll eat lots of other aphids, including non-economic species. They have competitively displaced a lot of native ladybugs because they are so good at what they do and so aggressive. Lots of non-target impacts on species that are totally harmless. And worse from the human perspective is they're from Asia, and in Asia, their favorite space to spend the winter, ladybugs tend to overwinter as adults. They sort of get in a suppressed physiological state and just ride out the winter hidden in a crack or crevice. And they like vertical, light-colored cliff faces. Well, here in central Illinois, it's kind of hard to find those light-colored vertical cliff faces. So the next best thing is a house, and they'll find a crack and they'll find a crevice and they'll go into your house and try to spend the winter. And if you try to disturb them, they will bite you, and that's kind of destroyed years and years of good public relations on the part of ladybugs. They smell bad. Some people have an allergic reaction or other reaction to their distasteful secretions because they taste bad. Not many other organisms will eat them. So they're kind of they had a banner year. They're really thriving here in North America, but expensive of a lot of our native fauna. Now, you can't rule them out altogether as bad guys, or you can't just sort of lump them in the bad guy category, because one reason they had such a good year last year, apparently, is that we have another invasive species in our soybean field. It's called the soybean aphids, Aphis glycinis, which showed up in the Midwest in the year 2000. First imported aphid pest of soybeans basically ever. Major concern, causes 30% or more yield reductions in some parts of the country, in Minnesota and the like. Big worries here in central Illinois. Well, guess what ate them? So it's like their old friends from China getting reacquainted. So it was a banner year for soybean aphids, and the multicolored Asian ladybugs came in and chowed down. And just goes to show what happens. I mean, this is an insect fear film. It's when when humans mess with the environment. This is what we get.
That's what happens. Okay. Let's talk with somebody here in Pena, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a comment and a question. I've noticed in the summer, you were speaking earlier, we called them katydids. What's the newer name for those? It's a more of a scientific name for those evening insects. They're not katydids, but locusts.
Well, no, we actually call them Katydids, Tetaganeans, if you want the family name.
There's another name that
Cicadas. You're talking about cicadas?
Cicadas.
Okay, yeah.
No, those are two different things.
Right.
Yeah. Now, anyway, some of those love to gather of an evening in the summer near street lights. I just thought I'd mention that. If you go into the dark part of the yard, there aren't any, there's no noise, but they love to gather around street lights. I just thought I'd mention that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they're katydids or other. But anyway, my main question was, we have those big black carpenter ants in our log cabins in our Coal Creek village here. And I'm going to hang up after I ask this. I just thought maybe you might have a comment on how to treat them. They're old logs in the cabins.
Well, again, as David said at the beginning of the show, getting rid of insects isn't my strong suit. That's what Phil Nixon does. I'm the fount of useless information about their, you know, what their likes and dislikes are and what their life cycles all about. And, for example, why insects flock to lights, including cicadas. And to make a long story short, basically insects flock to lights and immolate themselves, apparently because of an evolutionary short circuit where they're accustomed to maintaining a constant orientation to a distant point source of light, like the moon. It's sort of a celestial navigation short circuit. There are no natural point sources of light, basically. So we've created this anomaly, and they're orienting to lights as if they're at great distances, and they're not, so they're constantly readjusting their angle, and they end up spiraling in. And if it's a candle flame or incandescent light, it's to their detriment. But give Phil Nixon a call at University of Illinois Extension, and he can tell you how to get rid of your carpenter ants.
Right. Well, there we will have to leave it. Again, if you're looking for something interesting to do this weekend, you could stop by the 21st Annual Insect Fear Film Festival at the Folinger Auditorium. The doors open around 6, and it's free, and it's a good time. Thank you very much.
Yeah, look forward to seeing everybody.
May Barenbaum is our guest. She is the head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I, and I'm sure later on in the spring we'll be back and we'll do it again. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The program made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at thriftynickelads.com. The programming also made possible by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required, and individuals may join anytime. For more information, call 384-5829 or go to their website, which is www.livingyogacenter.net. Later today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with Ken Auletta, media critic of The New Yorker, talking about his new book, Backstory, Inside the Business of News. He told Publishers Weekly the debate over whether the media have liberal or conservative bias should take a backseat to another debate. He says the real bias is an economic bias and bias for conflict. You can hear that in the 1 o'clock hour. We're going to take a break. We'll have news first.